I'd like to talk to you first of all just briefly about Martin McGuinness, you know, the nature of the relationship. And I know you've been asked this before about, you know, what you think of him personally, but also about in political terms. I mean, do you trust him? Do you actually think he's sincere and committed to building a shared future, not only in Northern Ireland, but a genuine shared future between unionism and republicanism?
Well, I suppose it's worthwhile pointing out where I come from in terms of these kind of issues. My entry into politics came as a result of a friend being killed by the IRA. Therefore, you know, I look across the chamber at people who I recognise were involved in the murder of my friend, whether that's because they were in the same organisation or because they were in the leadership of that same organisation. And that does make the relationship obviously much more difficult. I have to say, having reached a situation where we're trying to bring peace and stability to Northern Ireland, having dealt with a number of other Sinn Féin leaders, I think it would have been impossible to have the working relationship that I have with Martin McGuinness with any of the others. I think undoubtedly he has no intention of going back to war. He does genuinely want the process to work. I don't minimise the fact that he wants it to work as a step towards a different goal than I would have. However, I think I'm winning on that front, because I think the clear evidence of the additional support that there's been for the union is there. And a stable Northern Ireland is a Northern Ireland which will be much more easy to convince people to remain within the United Kingdom.
But in terms of that, that's an interesting point you say about Martin McGuinness. You know, you think he's serious, but there seemed to be a slight suggestion there that maybe Sinn Féin collectively isn't as serious. In other words, if he wasn't their linchpin figure, you know, do you think you would be able, not you personally, but maybe the DUP and Sinn Féin, without you two, would it be possible to keep any relationship going?
Well, no one quite knows, because Sinn Féin takes the most unexpected decisions sometimes as to who their ministers would be. So there's no saying who, if Martin McGuinness wasn't there, that they would bring forward. But, for instance, I cannot imagine that the process would have worked, certainly would not have worked as well as it has, and I put that in inverted commas, if it had been Gerry Adams, for instance, that had put himself forward for the First Minister, Deputy First Minister's position.
In terms then of the shared future, everyone's talking about it, you've mentioned it in previous conference speeches, McGuinness talks about it. Given, you know, what we're seeing today with the Spads debate and the whole battle over how you define victims, what happened with the, whether there's going to be a shrine or not at the Maze, I mean, do you actually think there can be what anyone could credibly describe as a shared future? And when you use the phrase, what do you mean? When you talk about a shared future in Northern Ireland, what do you actually mean by that?
Well, let me deal with the two parts of the question. First of all, there is something of a difficulty in accepting a concept where we work together in government to govern Northern Ireland, where we cannot agree on the past, and we are not agreed on the ultimate future, and that obviously provides limitations in terms of what you can do. But we are agreed that the future should be decided by democratic means alone, and on that basis I'm comfortable. In terms of the shared future, I suppose it is the normalisation of societal relationships that I'm talking about, where people can interact, where there should not be a distinction in terms of where you can go and who you can play with on the basis of their religious or political background. So to some extent it's I suppose you could call it an integrated future, where our schools would be integrated, where our social lives would be integrated, where our housing would be integrated. All of those things would happen. I'm just a pragmatist in politics. And I don't think you can go from where we are to where we want to be in one step.
But do you think that the first step needs to come from the top? Because some people would say if what happens in the bottom is reflective of what's happening at the top, if the DUP and Sinn Féin, and I include the other parties in this, seem to find it so difficult to actually get a working relationship, even almost in some senses a friendly relationship with each other, that if they're incapable of doing that, how can they themselves ever produce legislation or a game plan for the rest of us?
Well, I think you and a number of other commentators are unnecessarily harsh in terms of what has been achieved. And you know, I don't think that you'd make, to quote Voltaire, the perfect the enemy of the good. You know, we have made massive progress in Northern Ireland. We have working relationships. We have made very significant changes to life in Northern Ireland. No, there are still faults, there are still imperfections, and very clearly there's progress that still has to be made. But you know, don't underestimate the fact that you know, from where we have come, there have been very significant strides forward, and that should be an example to the rest of the community. People as diametrically opposed to each other, both in terms of background, in terms of culture, in terms of religion, in terms of political ideology, can work together to a common and agreed programme for government, then surely that is an example to the rest of the community that people should be trying to work together and trying to have a better understanding of each other.
But if that's true, and I am unnecessarily critical at times, it goes with the territory, but then why do you think there's appears to be such a disengagement from the electorate and general public and the Assembly? And more important, maybe, why does there seem to be no enthusiasm for people voting, coming out like time after time to endorse what's happening? Do you not think there's a sense that it's because they don't see, that they in fact may feel more polarised, more distant than they've ever been, and that's what's stopping them coming out?
Well, I think you'll find that the voting percentages in Northern Ireland are better and certainly no worse than those elsewhere in the United Kingdom. And to some extent, the reduction in the number of people coming out is because it isn't such a polarised issue any longer, that we're dealing with normal politics and social and economic policy. You know, I have to say that to some extent the way the press and the media deal with the Assembly is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if you have Stephen Dolan coming on every morning taking whatever fault that he might find in the way the system operates and blowing it up into unrecognisable proportions, then quite clearly you do start to feed out a general message that the Assembly is not working, that it's not doing anything, that Assembly members are on some sort of a holiday. The reality is very different, and even the people that are facilitating that kind of debate know that the reality is very different.
Yeah, but I mean, you say that, and I accept that it's the nature of how Nolan does the show. But I mean, it's also true that quite a few DUP MLAs will go on that programme on a regular basis. Most of it is attack dog stuff. It's against either the UUP or the SDLP or the Alliance or Sinn Féin. I mean, it sounds like you're trying to have it both ways. You're blaming the media, you're saying that they are reporting and concentrating on the negativity, and yet at the same time your own MLAs are on there actually, some people would argue, adding to the perception that the parties don't get on.
I could put 20 statements out about the positive things that the Assembly and Executive have done, and I would not get the coverage collectively on those 20 statements that I would if I put out a statement attacking Sinn Féin or having some controversial issue raised. That's the reality of life. We have to live with that reality. And maybe we do need more on the part of the executive and being able to sell the positives of what we are doing, perhaps campaigning more on that basis. And that's something that I think we do have to look at. I don't blame the media per se, because I think we've been, as an executive, poor at putting out our own message.
Could I take you back to, at what point did you realise, or the DUP collectively, at what point did you realise you were probably going to have to share power with Sinn Féin, and how difficult was it when you reached that? Because I presume a few people in the room would have decided, okay guys, we're not going to rewrite this agreement, the structures aren't going to disappear, we're going to have to deal with this. When did you reach that point, and how did you manage to sell it? Because you did sell it very successfully, generally.
Well, it wasn't so much that the DUP realised. The electorate voted during the referendum for this system. We made it clear before that. I was arguing for a no vote because there were a number of imperfections, to put it at its lowest, about the Belfast Agreement. But I made it clear at that time that should the agreement be passed, then there were some aspects of that agreement that could never be overturned and changed. And you know, it's a fact of history that you know, as soon as that kind of system had been set up, albeit that it fell apart on three or four occasions, that there were some elements of it that you were never going to be able to change in the future and had to be part of any future structure.
Some people would argue that rather than, and I think there's an element of truth in all of that in terms of it was going to be impossible, you were lumbered after the referendum, but there's an element that in some sense you endure what we have now rather than embrace it, you endure power sharing. Is that true?
Well, I'll come to that, but maybe just to fill the gap between your first question and that one, the reality of course was for us that having to accept that power sharing was going to be something that was going to be part of any future structure, and indeed one might even say this is a completely different area, that in future generations people might be very glad on the unionist side of such a structure. But leaving that tangent away, I mean, we saw, having accepted that power sharing must be there, we said we're not prepared to accept power sharing on the basis that David Trimble was prepared to accept it, that there had to be changes. There had to be changes in terms of the issue of decommissioning, in terms of support for the police and the rule of law, in terms of their involvement in criminality, in terms of a more accountable system of government rather than ministers and departments taking their own decisions. And you know, people laughed at us when we listed the range of issues that had to be changed, and particularly in terms of getting Sinn Féin to support the police and the rule of law. Yet one by one we got all of those changes. So while we accepted the principle of power sharing, we made sure that in power sharing that certain principles were going to be accepted. Because if we hadn't, I don't believe this system would have worked. It would have fallen apart just as the Trimble-led system did.
Well, you mentioned Trimble there. Looking back, do you think maybe, you know, given the circumstances, what he was dealing with, the divided party and so on, were you too critical of him?
I think we were critical, rightly so, of the kind of deal that he finally came forward with. And, you know, our criticism, I think, is borne out by the fact that we got the changes and we moved from a system that was incapable of providing stable government to one that is providing stable government, albeit short of perfection. So I think we were right to be critical. And of course, our argument with David Trimble wasn't anything to do with about his courage as a leader in taking forward proposals in spite of everything coming down around him, because it was a very difficult position for an individual to be in. It was just simply he had the wrong policy to start off with. And I think that if he'd stuck out for a better deal, there was a better deal to be had.
Was there a possibility that rather than leave the talks in July 97, that had the DUP and even the UKUP stayed at that time, it might have been possible to actually build in right from the beginning what you wanted, rather than have a situation where the really bad things went in which you couldn't deal with?
Yeah. Well, I always look at that question from
the other way side, yes.
Because, you know, we had an agreement with David Trimble, Paul McCartney and ourselves that we would leave the talks at such a time as Sinn Féin were brought in unless they had met the criteria. He stayed in and we kept to our word. I think we'd have been in a stronger position if we'd all come out and we'd made sure that the changes were made at that stage. So we could talk about these issues at an academic level. The reality is we are where we are, and I think Trimble has paid a high price for the fact that he didn't deal with key issues that needed to be dealt with.
1987, October 1987, you resigned as deputy leader of the DUP for 3 months. So you've never really talked much about that. Now, some people say it was because you were pretty unhappy with the response of both James Molyneux and Ian Paisley to the task force report, or to the fact that they were saying, look, it's been suggested to me that you three, Harold and Frank and yourself, had seen quite early on that there was going to be some sort of necessity for unionism to directly engage its political opponents in a way it hadn't been, and that you were just so miffed by the response of the leadership of both parties that you walked.
Well, it wasn't even an issue of whether we would negotiate with our political opponents at that stage. It was whether we would negotiate with Her Majesty's government. Mm-hmm. Of course, I always took the view that if you want to bring down the Anglo-Irish agreement as it was at that stage, you either had to do it actively on the streets by way of a full-blooded campaign of opposition, or else you had to negotiate it out of existence. It became evident to me that we were moving past the stage where the activity on the street was likely to lever any change. And in my view, and in Harold's, and in Frank's, you negotiate from a position of strength, not weakness. So that meant that we needed to get into negotiations while there still was an active presence of protest on the street in order to effect change, rather than for that to peter out and then us to enter into negotiations from a position of weakness.
So, but you came back
when they opened up discussions with the government.
That's how you cover that. But was there any sense that in the next 10 years, or maybe if you want to argue all the way through to 2007, the next 20 years, that it was a waste, unionism wasted its time, or in some sense maybe you personally, out of frustration, you were ending up doing things you didn't particularly want to do? It was almost like fruitless, because you knew there had to be negotiations.
Yeah. One of the issues with leadership more generally is that saying that something needs to be done, knowing that it needs to be done, there will still be a time for being able to effect that change. And that's down to convincing the community that those steps have to be taken. And the community obviously doesn't all arrive at the same point at the same time, so you need to be sure that there are sufficient people who recognise the need for that move before you take that move.
So how do you respond to the sections of unionism and loyalism who suggest, particularly over the past few months, that you've sold out, you know, you've rolled over, you've become another Trimble, but you have seen it described as a Lundy as well, you know, who's taken this view that with every other unionist leader, you got to the top and then you just thought, oh, this is great, you sell out, as they would say it.
Well, I thought we had an election in 2011. I thought in that election all of the facts were known. People knew that we were in an all-party government with five parties involved. People knew what the relationship would be between the DUP and Sinn Féin, because we'd already been in government before that with them. So nobody was in any doubt what they were voting for in 2011. Yet I came back here with the largest team that the Democratic Unionist Party has ever had. So of course there are people who are against what we're doing.
How do you take? I mean, I accept all of that, but I mean, you personally, does it hurt that people are almost as vitriolic, you know, in their response to you? I'm not saying all of it, but there are sections as vitriolic to you as they were to Trimble, as they were to Faulkner. No, do you take it personally?
I think if you were to take these things personally, you would be looking for a different profession. I think if there's any annoyance, it's the nature of the arguments that are presented, the inaccuracies of the comments, the fact that you have, particularly in the social media, all sorts of tomfoolery and nonsense which is so far from reality and honesty that it probably is better to press the delete button on it. It's long past the stage where I start personally having any reaction to those kind of comments. In politics, you've got to know what you're doing is right. If you felt that what you were doing was a bit shaky or something that was improper, quite clearly would have an impact on you.
So you're convinced that what you're doing is right? Is right for unionism, right for Northern Ireland?
I have no doubt that while I can understand, particularly with victims, that they have great difficulty in coming to terms with the ability of Sinn Féin to be in government, albeit because they had a democratic vote to put them there. The reality, of course, is that Northern Ireland has changed. It's changed for the better. I go out and about. I probably speak to more people than any other politician would. I have the invitations to go and meet people. On the one hand, I get the kind of comments that you're talking about from people who will support the TUV or the PUP. But the overwhelming view out there of the community is that this is the right course to take. Of course, it still has to be reformed. Of course, it still has to be improved. There are a lot of things that can and should be done, and in their time will be. Compare where we are now with where we were 10, 15 years ago, and it's obvious this is the right course to take.
In a speech, I think it was last year, maybe it was the last year's party conference, I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something about you can't write off, those thousands of Catholics who are probably unionists and are certainly not left-wing. Do you think that not simply just writing them off, but you've made them feel excluded by this whole approach to the unionist forum, which some people think it's like circling the wagons, it's going back to another time, some sort of safety comfort zone, that rather than actually reach out, which is what you seem to be suggesting you were doing, you have gone back?
Somehow I find it difficult when I hear this argument, because the people who make the argument obviously equate unionism with Protestantism.
That's the problem, Peter.
If you're a Catholic, why would you not want to embrace a unionist forum if that was your political outlook? What we need to do is to get away from the kind of categorisation of unionism as Protestantism. It is all embracing. It should be open to all, not just from the Catholic community, but from those who have no religious background. Or indeed some other religious faith background.
But then why the unionist forum? Because I think in your Covenant Dinner speech, which is a great speech by the way, and I wrote it at the time, you talked about a council for the union, which would bring together all of the pro-union family, and I thought that was a really good idea. But it seems to me that there's a significant difference between something called a council for the union, which appears to be open to everyone, and something, another vehicle that seems in some sense to be a slightly knee-jerk reaction vehicle called the Unionist Forum. You seem to think there's no difference between the two.
The Unionist Forum has been given a specific remit, and it would be a remit that would be much more limited than the kind of Unionist Council of the Union that I referred to. The Unionist Forum was born out of the fact that there were many people who believed that there were issues within the unionist community that were not being addressed. In some cases, the issues were relating to the economic difficulties that various areas of the province were facing. Others were matters of identity. None of them, I would have thought, were issues that were sectarian by their nature. The fact is that the unionist identity is strong, in my view, in 2012, probably was expressed in much more forthright and robust terms than in any part of my political life, with the Covenant celebrations, the visit of Her Majesty the Queen, meeting more people than at any of our previous visits to Northern Ireland. So I think some of the issues needed to be addressed head on. Other issues, such as how do we increase the vote for the union, are matters which we can cooperate with others, and through the forum proposals will come forward. If there are areas where there's greater deprivation, then let's address those issues. Let's see proposals. If there is educational underattainment with a section of our community.
But how do you, going back to what you said earlier about the you know, the falling turnout was maybe reflective of a sense of content to be there. There wasn't this sense of polarisation or us and them anymore, so that's why people are reasonably content not to vote. How do you maximise the pro-union vote against that? If you're saying people are already happy, what do you say to the pro-union family that makes them come out? If you're already saying, well, they're actually happy, they don't feel the need to go out anymore.
Well, if you're asking the pro-union family to come out in terms of voting to remain within the United Kingdom, then that really only is directly relevant when it comes to an election for on the basis of a referendum. In terms of social and economic policy, I think it is vital in the context of, for instance, the Assembly, which the Assembly is based at present on a structure which requires the First Minister to come from the largest political party represented in the Assembly, which has the seats in the executive divvied up in terms of the strength of the political parties. So if unionists want to have the maximum representation, then they effectively have to vote for the parties that can bring representation to the executive or to the First Minister's office. So to some extent, the unionist identity gets furthered in that context. So the more people that vote, the more representation you have, the stronger the unionist representation in the Assembly is.
But isn't there also true, you talk about, you know, the unionist representation may be maximised, but it seems to be that it's constant division, you know, that unionism seems prone, even that 15, 16 years after the agreement, to constantly divide with the TUV emergence, and UKIP seems to be getting, we've no idea what Basil and John are going to do in the next few weeks. And every time another unionist voice emerges, it's not to talk about the collective, holistic approach to unionism. It's actually to have a dig at each other.
Yeah. Well, I think there is an extent to which, whether you take the propensity of Protestant churches to split and to form new institutions, whether you talk about the unionist parties and their propensity to do the same. It's probably part of the character and nature of our community. However, there is a recognition, I think, on the part of the unionist community that they do need to have a strong, solid bloc that can show a unionist strength in the face of the Republican agenda, because no matter what level of agreement we might be able to reach within the Assembly, there still is a Republican agenda, there still is a unionist agenda. So people have to be able to influence that, and they can only influence that by voting for the largest party.